Welcome to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening. Well, it might be hot and muggy in Philadelphia, but in Second Life, the skies are clear, and little figures called avatars are going about their business. Second Life is one of many virtual universes games where people assume identity and create lives for themselves. The creators of Second Life, Linden Labs, report that on a typical day, players spend $1 million buying virtual clothes, cars, houses, and other goods for their avatars. According to a Dutch study, 33% of players spend more than 30 hours a week in the game. Which begs the question, why? What's the appeal? How does it work? Well, on today's show, we'll explore some of these questions on virtual universes, and we'll discuss their therapeutic possibilities. We'll hear from a researcher who studied 40,000 online gamers. We'll meet a therapist who practices in Second Life, and we'll talk to a scientist who uses virtual worlds to treat disorders like PTSD. But first, let's hear an interview with Kyra. In real life, she's a project manager in New Jersey. In Second Life, she's known as the Diva Rockin' and hosts a popular podcast. She gave our producer, Mike and Scott, a tour of her Second Life.
Right now, we are in Martha's Vineyard, a recreation of Martha's Vineyard within Second Life, where I have my primary home. If I fly up, you can kind of get an idea of this, what they call as a sim, is an island, and people rent or purchase land and build their homes here.
So describe yourself. I look at you from the back right now.
Ooh, so you can see me.
There we go. Yes. All right, describe your avatar.
Well, originally I had started with wanting her to look as much like me as I could. I have a little bit of weight on me. I try to keep her lean, but, you know, average size figure. I'm short. She's about the same height as I am in real life. And I keep her hair and whatnot. And if I'm not wearing sunglasses, I'm usually wearing glasses similar to my real-life glasses. She's average, but she's got lots of sparkly clothes.
She looks a little bit like Holly Golightly in Breakfast at Tiffany's.
Yes, and I did get somebody to refer to me, and it's the hairstyle. I have different hairstyles, too, which it's a big business. Hair is something that I've spent a lot of money on.
So you have to buy your hair?
You buy your hair, yep. Let me see if I have some basic hair. Okay, this is my original hair, and you can see the difference just in the way it moves. It doesn't really have much to it.
Right, right. So basically you have a drop-down menu here, and mm-hmm. you can pick your hair, you can get skin, you can get mm-hmm. body parts.
You can, basically, they start you off, you have a basic shape, a basic skin. If you do decide that you want to invest money and create an appearance other than what the basic tools give you, then you're able to go shopping. I am going to take you shopping.
Did you put your good hair back on?
No. And hopefully nobody sees me and takes my picture. God forbid. No.
Oh, you can take pictures?
Yes, you can take pictures too.
How much money do you spend on average in a month?
Is my husband going to hear this? I'm a shopaholic. I've also been building, so I've been buying textures to build with. I would say I spend at least $50 a month, and that's including my monthly membership, which is $9.95.
Now, does your character, the Diva Rockin', mm-hmm. does she have a boyfriend?
She does have a boyfriend. She has a few boyfriends, but she has a number one, who is Gideon Television, and he is a popular character within the game. We actually live together on Martha's Vineyard. You know, we'll meet up, we'll go to parties, or we'll hang out, or just go on adventures. There's a lot to do as couples in the game. And actually, a neat story is our neighbors who live on Martha's Vineyard here, a woman and a man who are married in real life, but he's recently disabled and can't leave the bed. So things that they used to be able to do, like go out dancing or go to movies, they don't have that opportunity to do anymore. They can recreate that within their Second Life. So they joined up as a means of getting back those sort of activities.
What does your husband think of your character and your character having a boyfriend?
He gave me permission to date. He does know about Gideon. He knows that we have a home together. He asks me how come he doesn't live there, but he doesn't have an avatar, so he can't very well live there. He is the complete opposite of... He doesn't even have an email account. So he is so computer illiterate. A lot of it is over his head. And he just doesn't... He doesn't want to learn. So for him, it's like, okay, whatever, she's playing her game.
Do these characters get intimate with each other? Or is it more just, you know, you go out on dates?
Okay, well, a big part of Second Life that is probably the most known is there is a sex industry. There's clubs, there's strippers, there's escorts. And unfortunately, most of what people learn about Second Life, the first thing they learn is about those sorts of places. But it's so much bigger than that. There are ways to simulate intercourse and being intimate with somebody, yes. There's a lot of that. And there's lands that are dedicated specifically to role-playing and sexual situations.
Can we go into your house?
Yes.
Is your boyfriend home?
No.
Where is he?
I have no idea. He's probably at home working.
How much time do you spend on average in a week?
I have a tracker. And I spend a lot of time. I work 9 to 5. I'm usually signing into Second Life by 7 p.m. Eastern. So I'll come home, I'll have dinner. I will spend from 7 till at least midnight if I'm dedicating myself into the game on a weeknight. On the weekends, I tend to pop in and out a little bit because I do have other things that I do online with my podcasting and my website. And
that doesn't leave a lot of time for your first life.
Yes, unfortunately. Well, my husband also works full-time. His hours are unpredictable. He's a chef, and he's at the restaurant a lot. So, yeah, you don't have much of a social life in your real form, but this is also a lot of my social life. I'm not out at the bars. I'm not out, you know.
Do you ever miss that, though? Like, that experience, the real experience versus the...
I wouldn't say I miss it. Second Life can be addicting. I still go out for happy hour with, you know, my coworkers in real life. I still go to the mall and go shopping. I still go on vacations. But you can really get mentally involved in this game to the point where it's like, you know, you can't wait to get in. I have to build this, or I have an idea I want to create, or I want to set up a party for such and such theme. The time goes by quite quickly, and before you know it, it's, oh my god, it's midnight, I have to go to bed, I have work in the morning.
Do you develop real feelings, though, for the people you interact with, whether they are real or not? Like the boyfriend you have. Do you know him in real life?
We have met in real life. Yes, you know, I would say you do. You even with friendships, it doesn't have to be a romantic relationship. He's one of my best friends, and we definitely have a caring relationship that was founded within the game before we had even met in real life. So I think, you know, depending on how much you're willing to open yourself up to those types of relationships, virtual relationships, then yeah, you definitely can develop some feelings for these people. They're like an extended family.
So if he broke up with the diva, would you, Kira, be upset?
If I didn't have him as a friend, I definitely would be upset. You know, we spend a lot of time together. We talk about all kinds of things.
In Second Life.
In Second Life. In real life, we communicate through emails. We also communicate through Skype, the voiceover IP. Yeah, I think I would definitely feel like I had lost one of my best friends. So I would be affected by that, yeah. And hopefully that doesn't happen.
And your husband isn't jealous?
I don't think so, no. We've kind of always had, you know, our independent lifestyles. We come together and you know, he in real life is my best friend, yes. But his schedule is just so crazy that I think he probably prefers that I'm, you know, at home at least.
Which one of your lives do you like better?
my second life, of course. I can lose 20 pounds in 2 seconds. I can wear, you know, Hope Diamonds and what they call bling. I think I'm a little more famous in my second life than I am in my first life, so of course I prefer that. You know, you don't get sick, you don't have to eat. You can fly. Who wouldn't want to fly?
That was Kira in real life, and in second life, she's known as the Diva Rockin', and she was interviewed by Mike and Scott. Well, our first guest today is Dr. Nick Yee. He's a recent PhD graduate from Stanford University, where he studied the psychology of online games and virtual environments. He's well known for an ongoing study that has surveyed over 40,000 gamers online. Nicky, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Dan.
And you are just the man I want to talk to after listening to that interview. My first reaction is, what was that? What just happened there?
That was a great interview. I think it really gave a really, you know, good inside look from a user's perspective. And I think a lot of the words or the interactions that, you know, Kira just used might have been confusing for a lot of non-gamers.
Well, it highlighted the good news and bad news and much of what's in the middle, too. First, I'm thinking as I was listening to the interview about the creators in Linden Labs and where these ideas come from. I wonder how many of the creative minds in Linden Labs have Asperger's or social anxiety disorder.
The programmers themselves?
Yeah, that are kind of isolated people that are more comfortable with screens than humans.
Well, it's interesting. I mean, it's a common stereotype of, you know, a lot of video game users in general. You know, but one of the things, especially in these social worlds, is, you know, there's some data that kind of counters that. So, for example, we usually think of a lot of these people as being loners, but a lot of them, you know, for example, 80% of online gamers actually use the environment to stay in touch with people, you know, who they know in the physical world that may not be geographically located. So, for example, in, you know, other online games like in World of Warcraft, a lot of players play with their distant family members or their colleagues and so forth in a way that it's more interactive than, say, talking on the phone or, you know, and being able to collaborate on a project together. So, for example, in Second Life, they could, you know, build a house and, you know, design a dinner party together. In World of Warcraft, they could work together over a four-hour period in a strategic situation. So in its way, it's collaborative. You know, I think I'd shy away from, you know, labeling all video game users and video game designers as, you know, as being...
Let's stretch it out a little bit. I want to know a bit about your findings. So tell us about who would join this kind of community and why. Apparently there's a pretty wide gamut, pretty wide
there
range.
There is. There are essentially two broad strains of virtual environments. There are the more game-like environments like World of Warcraft, where people are elves and ogres and they kill dragons, so the role-playing fantasy side. And there's the more social side like Second Life, where the predominant activity is centered around user-created content. People build houses, create parties and dance clubs, and that's the dominant activity. But in both these games, the age range is pretty wide. On average, it's around 26 to 30 years old. So most of these users aren't teenagers. In fact, in the main grid of Second Life, you have to be over the age of 18 to join, so the age range is actually skewed higher in Second Life than in games like World of Warcraft. In the online game side, the users spend about 20 hours a week in those environments on average. I'm not sure about the exact number in Second Life. You know, so these are people who, a lot of whom, you know, are married, have children, you know, and they're spending almost, you know, half a work week, if not more, in these virtual environments. So what's clear is that there's something very compelling about them.
Is it, well, there's something, perhaps something compelling about them. I am sure that's the case, and I'd like to know what. And, you know, one wonders about their motivations. Is there something that's not fulfilling about one's primary life? I mean, we heard threads of that in Kira's story.
You know, we definitely heard threads of that. And, you know, that, you know, spans whole spectrum. So there are situations, for example, where, you know, virtual worlds enable people to meet and make friends with others from different states, different countries, and so forth, different cultural backgrounds or different backgrounds just in general that they don't have access to in the physical world. Because in the physical world, you know, we're really limited to making friends with people who are immediately situated with us. So there are situations where being online helps broaden your social network. Of course, there's the more dangerous side, you know, where it gets, you know, there's entanglement with love and relationships, and oftentimes it may not be as so easy to role play being in love with someone else, and not to slowly, you know, also develop romantic feelings for them. That, you know, that it's possible for some players, but it's very difficult for other, you know, for other players. So it really spans a spectrum. That there are things that may be fairly positive. So, for example, in games like World of Warcraft, a teenager could potentially lead a guild of 50 adults, you know, if he's sufficiently mature, and that's an opportunity that they don't have in the physical world. You know, so there's really a spectrum, and it's really not, you know, there's really not one broad stroke of good or bad, but, you know, really have to, you know, look at the spectrum and see what the player's doing.
And of course, we wonder whether, you know, some people get involved for social contact that they wouldn't ordinarily have, and that's good. On the other side of that same argument is that could be protecting people from going out and making face-to-face social contacts too.
That's correct. So in certain cases, there are players who, for example, experience leadership opportunities in these game worlds, and it gives them the confidence to then later out and actually do those things in the physical world. But for others, it becomes like a vicious cycle. It becomes like a crutch that it enables them, but they're not able to actually transfer those skills or that increased confidence to the physical world. It's like kind of like Dumbo's feather. You know, so I've seen both cases, and it's not immediately clear, you know, why it happens for some people and it doesn't happen for others. But it's clear that they both happen.
Yeah, my producer, Mike and Scott, just sent in an interesting and provocative question that gave me perspective. She said, is it better than watching TV? And you know, I immediately thought of the passivity of watching TV, where you're sitting back and stuff is just going into your head, and it's not at all interactive.
And that was actually a point I raised, earlier with Mike, and as well, is that it's really ironic that a lot of people are up in arms about these online games, where the real alternative for a lot of people is just watching TV. And not only the passivity that you just mentioned, but also that most people watch TV with their families in silence. You know, so instead of talking with each other, the TV effectively kills their interaction too.
Yeah, and most families have multiple TVs, so even
in their own room, so they don't even have to be in the same place to watch TV anymore.
Nick, we've got to take a short break. There's so much more I want to talk about avatars and the social norms in these virtual environments. Mm-hmm. One of your articles. We are talking about virtual environments like Second Life or online games. My guest today is Dr. Nick Yi. He's a recent PhD graduate from Stanford University. He studied the psychology of online games and virtual environments. We'll be back to talk with Dr. Yi in just 1 minute. I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
The University of Pennsylvania proudly supports WHYY. If you or someone you know is between the ages of 13 and 18, using drugs or alcohol, and having difficulty paying attention or sitting still, Penn's Rehab After School in Paoli has a research study that may be of help. For more information, the number is 610-644-6464, extension 563. 610-644-6464, extension 563.
On the next Fresh Air, high-stakes confrontations with the Bush administration over Alberto Gonzalez, Iraq, and other issues. We talk with New York Times reporter Carl Hulse about the current state of the U.S. Congress. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 here on WHYY 91 FM.
And we're back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about virtual worlds and Second Life. My guest is Dr. Nick Yee. He got his PhD from Stanford, where he studied the psychology of online games and virtual environments. Nick, I want to talk about these avatars. Over the last several years, you've surveyed a lot of people. I want to know who picks what. I mean, we heard from Kira in the beginning that she was pretty faithful to who she is, but I would imagine there's a lot of gender bending or creating an ideal self.
Yeah, so on just the basic issue, I mean, there seems to be a trend depending on your personality. So introverts are slightly more likely to create avatars that are idealized or similar versions of who they are. Extroverts, on the other hand, tend to create characters that are deliberately different from who they are. They tend to be a little more adventurous, and so they deliberately try out new personalities with their avatars. There's a really interesting issue in gender bending. So in these environments, male users are actually about 3 to 5 times more likely to gender bend than female users.
Any idea why?
Yeah, so I at first had a lot of, you know, deep-seated psychological or sociological reasons why, but when I asked players about this in the online games such as World of Warcraft, a lot of them gave very instrumental reasons. So they'll say, if I have to stare at someone's behind for 20 hours a week, I'd rather be staring at someone's behind that I'm attracted to. Or they'll say, and a lot of guys will say this, I created a female avatar because female avatars are treated better online. And it's something that a lot of players have experienced, that a female avatar will get more free gifts, will get invited to groups more often, are treated more leniently when they make a mistake in a group. So in a sense, they gain a psychological edge. So a lot of guys do that, but then they'll say, and then I realize that it's a double-edged sword, that when you're in a female body, apart from all the good stuff, you also get a lot of, you know, attention, unwanted attention, and sexual harassment. That's actually also the primary reason why the few women who gender bend do so in online games. It's specifically so that they can get away from the sexual harassment.
Which brings us to one of your articles with a title that I just loved. It was called The Unbearable Likeness of Being Digital, Persistence of Nonverbal Social Norms in the Online Environments. So what is that? What are the social norms? Are they looser? Are they identical?
Yeah, so for that study, what we were trying to do is to understand, you know, a lot of people are interested in using these worlds as, you know, scientific platforms, you know, digital laboratories where we can study a lot of phenomena. But the first step to answering that question is, you know, whether anything transfers to these virtual worlds. You know, do people create a whole new social interaction system in these worlds? So we picked a few interaction norms that we knew and are supported by literature in the physical world. So, for example, people keep a personal space around each other, that in casual situations, when you put two people who are too close together, they are forced to look away, otherwise the situation is too intimate. It's like being in an elevator, and why when you look at someone face-to-face in the elevator and you're close, it's very uncomfortable. You know, so we took a lot of those norms, you know, and also a lot of gender differences as well, and so we went in and we started looking at whether, you know, do those norms transfer to Second Life? Are they broken in interesting ways, or is there a completely new set of interactions? And what we found was that of all the ones that we looked at, they, for the most part, did seem to replicate in Second Life. So we collected a lot of data using the underlying system and actually got, you know, exact coordinates and the ways that people's bodies were turned. And we found that, you know, indeed, the closer that two people were in a casual setting, the less likely they were to maintain eye contact because they had to avert their gaze, otherwise the situation became too intimate. And we found, you know, differences like that. You know, for example, also that male avatars are less likely to maintain eye contact with each other than female avatars are. You know, and that's also a finding we had.
So it sounds like that what you're finding is consistent with the great philosophers who might say, no matter where we go, we always take us with us.
You know, correct, because it's really hard to unlearn a lot of those, you know, social, cultural lessons that, you know, we've been, you know, repeating, practicing daily for, you know, our lives. And it's really hard to just, you know, to say that we can pick a new body in a virtual world and just forget all those lessons. And I think that's part of what we're seeing, that it's, you know, that it's really still psychologically uncomfortable for you to be really close to someone and be looking at them if you're only casually acquainted.
Can you tell us the difference between virtual relationships and real ones? What happens online and how?
Yeah, so I mean, one thing that a lot of people have known in the who study this area is that people are less inhibited online. They're more likely to say personal, you know, say very personal things about themselves and say them in fairly intimate ways and be more direct about their emotions. And of course, it's a variety of reasons. First of all, they are truly anonymous, that, you know, unless they, you know, reveal who they are, no one knows who they are. So there's that safety net. There's the idealization aspect that Kira touched upon in an interview, that, you know, because people are able to be more comfortable with their bodies, they don't have to worry about, oh, does my hair look good? Oh, do I have to hold my stomach in so my belly doesn't show? You know, do I have to stand up more straight? Because all that's done for you in the online world. And all that extra energy can get, you know, redirected to the conversation content itself. You know, one interesting study that I did among the online gamers was I specifically asked players who had begun a relationship online and then it moved to the physical environment, and they're physically dating now. One of the questions I asked them was, do you think you would have dated this person had you first met face-to-face? And over 60% of those respondents actually said no. You know, this wouldn't have happened had it started face-to-face. And they said the reason why it started was because we met online. It wasn't a romantic relationship at first. It was a working, collaborative relationship. And, you know, I felt that I liked their character a lot. And my, you know, one story my dad tells kind of helps clarify the story. So my dad is a golfer, and I don't play golf. But my dad says, I play golf with my business partners because it lets me see who cheats on the golf course. And, of course, what he means is that games can be character-revealing. And that's what a lot of these players will say, is that the game was character revealing, and it's only after, you know, they got a good sense of this person's character under stress and with other players, you know, that they then, you know, met them in real life and got to understand them. And the reason why they wouldn't have, you know, dated this person had they first met face-to-face is they would have been distracted by the superficial cues. Oh, he's too old, he's too young, he's too blonde, he's too blue-collar, he's, you know, too skinny and whatnot. But because they met online, they kind of knew each other from the inside out. So there's some really interesting themes in there that in certain cases, it can be a very deceptive and a dangerous relationship when the initial contact is very much focused on the body, the hair, the clothing. But in other environments where it's more focused on the working relationship, it may be a little less superficial.
Your dad's comment about golf raises another interesting point. At a certain level, we are all multiple avatars. You're one person when you're in front of a classroom, one when you're in an intimate relationship, and another when you're doing something else. I mean, there are different aspects of your personality that come to the fore.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things why when people say, you know, how can people deal with being someone else, you know, isn't that distracting or confusing? And that's the point that I'll bring that you just said, is that, well, no, in the real world, all of us play multiple roles to begin with, as a, you know, as a parent, as a child, as a mentor, as a student, and so forth. That's absolutely right.
One of your findings, I believe it was yours when I did the research, was that 50% of the people report that they feel addicted to the game.
Yeah, and it's one of these findings that really needs to be qualified, in the sense that at that point I just threw the word out there. You know, it was asked point blank, you know, would you consider yourself addicted to the game? And it wasn't defined in any way. You know, so you have to take it with, you know, with that sense. And so I always interpret it as a sense that of how involved people are, you know, in the games. A lot of them, you know, say that, you know, they're addicted to it, but it has no real negative, you know, impact on their, you know, except, you know, they lose sleep every once in a while. The other thing we don't know is that, for example, we went, you know, and asked viewers of the TV show Lost or 24, and we asked them, would you consider yourself addicted to Lost or 24? We don't know what the base rates where those numbers are, but, you know, cursory glances at those forums also say a lot of people throw that word around. So, you know, my sense is it was one of the earlier surveys that I did, you know, and one thing I caution is that it's really easy to misread that and say that, you know, 50% of people play these games and have significant negative consequences in their lives, that's not the case, that it's clear that some people do, but that, you know, that word addiction is actually very, very slippery as it's currently used, because different people mean very different things when they use that word.
You said on your webpage that you had recently become pretty ill, and among other things, you had great pain. You said that playing video games helped you more than the medication. Do you think that's one of the functions of the video games, is to distract us from social or emotional pain?
Wow, that's a good... the way I always framed it was that there are certain cases where video games, and this was before my illness, where video games can provide opportunities to people that they actually don't have in the physical world, whether that's because they have a limited social network in the real world, just because of where they live. They're in a rural city somewhere. You know, but also there are people who may be physically challenged, or they are trying to deal with Asperger's, or they are trying to deal with sociophobias, and these online environments help provide either ways to gain access to that or as stepping stones towards that. So in a guided environment with a therapist, these could be incredibly therapeutic. But I think, you know, again, that there is a spectrum. There are people, as I mentioned earlier, for whom it does become a kind of a crutch where the online environment is enabling in a way, but they're not able to transfer that confidence out to the physical environment. You know, for me, it really was, you know, personally, it was really just the distraction from the pain that, you know, I'd never experienced it before. You know, it was, I had a severe allergic reaction to an antibiotic, and so 90% of my body was covered with a thick rash, and I couldn't stop the itching, and I was on a steroid and an antihistamine, and it still couldn't stop the itching. I couldn't fall asleep. And so, you know, if I couldn't distract myself from the itching, I would have bled myself to death because of the scratching. And it really was... I never sensed that distraction in that way until then.
Well, fortunately, your pain was short-lived, and your need for distraction was also short-lived. You know, there are many whose pain has been embedded in them for a lifetime. I want to follow up though with your situation, Nick. You said during the worst of this, I'm coming back to your webpage. You said during the worst of this, you felt such great despair that you saw a counselor and you felt that it was cathartic. It was very healing. How would you have felt about seeing a counselor online?
I think it wouldn't, like for me personally, because so much of the counseling session is about the conversation, and I felt I had so much to talk about that I think I would have felt a little more limited if I were personally online and having had to type it out, if only because I had typed the story out already, you know. And so I needed to really talk to someone about it. That was actually very important to me at that point. You know, I can see now where if it weren't such an urgent, you know, crisis situation, I might, you know, it's less of an issue for me to have done it, you know, in a digital online environment. But I think it really depends on, you know, what you're trying to talk about with your therapist, you know, and whether that's the right environment. I think there are certain kinds of situations where that might be helpful, but others where it's not. But most therapists actually prefer to talk,
face to face. Well, we're gonna have to say goodbye to you. And when we, for the rest of our show, we're gonna talk with therapists who practice both in their office and online. Nikki, thanks so much for joining us.
And no problem. Thanks so much.
Your research is fascinating. Nikki is a recent PhD graduate from Stanford University. He studied the psychology of online games and virtual environments. Coming up, we'll explore the therapeutic possibilities of virtual worlds. We'll meet a therapist who practices as an avatar in Second Life, and we'll hear about a program designed for soldiers with PTSD. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY 91 FM.
One out of every four Americans gets sick from a foodborne illness each year. And with E. coli found in spinach and salmonella linked to some brands of peanut butter, Americans are left wondering how safe their food really is. Join us as we look at food safety in America from restaurant inspections to genetically engineered food, and whether cloning cows for meat is a good idea. On the next Justice Talking from NPR.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
Next time on Day to Day.
Think thoroughly about civilians, about damages.
Afghanistan's President Karzai meets with President Bush. An Afghan diplomat tells us they're worried about all the civilian deaths in the fighting there.
It's important for our government as well as our partners to win the war for heart and mind.
Afghanistan's other war, next time on Day to Day.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb. We're talking about virtual universes today and online gaming. So far, we've discussed what's attractive about them and how they interact with people's real lives, their primary lives. But now let's take a look at other possibilities these worlds offer for psychotherapy, for healing. In a little while, we'll take a look at how virtual worlds designed to help with disorders like PTSD and attention deficit disorder. But now, joining us is Dr. Craig Curley. He's a psychologist in private practice in Atlanta. He practices in person in his office, and he's also an avatar in Second Life. Craig, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
So, what kind of avatar are you?
Well, that's an interesting question. One of the things I decided to do in my online practice is to try to create an avatar that looks as much like me and as possible, so there'd be some continuity between real life and Second Life.
So you didn't do the Freudian goatee, horn-rimmed glasses, pinstripe.
Which is, I think, what a lot of people expect when they come to see me, yes.
Yeah. So how did you get interested in this practice in virtual reality, Second Life?
Well, I've always been interested in technology and using it in mental health, and been kind of, as my kids call me, a techno geek for quite a while. And I heard about Second Life about a year ago and checked into it and thought, you know, what a wonderful way to interact with people who may have limited access to mental health services.
So you visited, apparently, support groups that have been formed in Second Life. And how did they... Give us a feel for what they're like. This is all three-dimensional, yes?
Yes. So, what they were, when I first joined in on a discussion group that was already running, it was just basically a group of people who had issues and realized that they wanted to come in and talk with other people about, many of whom felt they were isolated in their real lives and just looking for other people to make them feel like they're not alone in the concerns that they have.
And these are like regular... groups is yeah. is there you know, the narcissist that dominates the group and the person that gets angry and withdraws and pouts?
Yes, often there is. Yeah, you find the regular group dynamics in these groups, and these tend to go more as discussion groups, open discussion groups, as compared to, say, you know, systematic certain number of sessions that we'll run. But you still do find people taking on the narcissistic role and people feeling put out by not getting enough attention in the group.
I guess it's like I said earlier in the show, that no matter where we go, there we are.
We are
with us. So tell us about your practice. What's it like?
Well, in Second Life, primarily what I do is I try to run weekly discussion groups. I took the summer off, but we're back and running those again, usually on issues related to relationships, and social anxiety is a very popular one. One of the things I noticed when I first came into Second Life is there are a number of people who purport to have real issues with social anxiety in real life, and that's one of the reasons they enjoy Second Life so much.
So these are a group of X number of people who meet on a certain day at a certain hour for 60 or 90 minutes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they type their issues so that everybody can read them.
Mm-hmm.
And what's your role?
Primarily, I'm a group facilitator and an educator in those settings. I'm there to listen, to see what's going on, to see what some of the main topics are, and to kind of bounce ideas off of them on things to try in their, not only in Second Life but in real life as well.
And what about the one-on-one therapy? How does that work, and how does it compare to your office?
Well, it's very different than one-on-one therapy in my office. It works in that I have a private location we go to, and up until recently, it's been strictly chat-based, typed text.
So it's just one-on-one in a private location, usually with clients who are just not able to access therapists where they live. It's been primarily the people who've taken advantage of this.
And is the fee structure the same?
The fee structure, at this time I'm charging a lower fee in Second Life, mainly because it's a fairly new environment and want to give people a chance to kind of get involved in that. But there is definitely a pay-for-service type
what,
situation.
What's it like for you?
Well, one of the main differences I see is there's a real ability for the client to sit and think about what they're going to say before they say it, get their thoughts together, and then a chance to kind of do the same thing when you're responding because it is all typed. And also what I find in Second Life is people generally tend to have lower levels of inhibitions. So it doesn't take quite as long to build trust. It doesn't take quite as long for people to really kind of tell their life story and to really get to the heart of the issue.
Let me, as a psychologist, I want to know what it's like for you compared to seeing people face-to-face. Is it more relaxing? Is it more gratifying, less gratifying?
I would have to say it's a very different experience. I find that I work with clients that are different than I usually do in my real life practice. So I find that interesting. I don't know that I would find it more relaxing, but I guess I just find it interesting.
Hmm. Well, you're off into a new world, literally and metaphorically. It's fascinating. I wish you the best, and I'd
Thank
like
you.
To come back and talk with you in a year or so, see how it's changed. I'm sure it will have by then.
Absolutely. Sounds great.
Dr. Craig Curley is a psychologist in private practice in Atlanta, where he practices in person in his office, and he also practices as an avatar in Second Life. Joining us now is Dr. Albert Skip Rizzo. He's a research scientist and research professor at the Institute for Creative Technologies at the University of Southern California. Skip, welcome to the show.
Hi.
You're involved with a program called, a conference called Medicine Meets Virtual Reality Medical Education. Who's at that conference? What's it about?
Well, yeah, this is a conference that's been going on for, I think, now 16 years, so it's not sort of a flash in the pan. And it's basically bringing together healthcare professionals that use technology either in their practice or in clinical research across a wide range of areas, whether it's virtual reality for anxiety disorders or surgical simulations that use digital models. So it's a wide spectrum of folks that come to this event.
Let's talk a little bit about your program at Southern California. You developed a program for returning American soldiers with PTSD. Tell us what it looks like.
Well, we call it Virtual Iraq. Not too creative of a title, but basically it's a series of scenarios, whether you're driving in a Humvee down a desert road or you're walking through a city or a village that has looks very Middle Eastern. And within that world, the therapist has a separate control panel that allows them to introduce stimuli at a graded or progressive pace so that...
For example,
if your traumatic event involved, being on a desert road in a Humvee and seeing a vehicle blow up, well, we might start the patient off with them sitting in a Humvee with no sound, no vibration, no smell, completely vacant environment, and it may take them a while just to get used to that. They're wearing a head-mounted display, of course, so they can turn their head and look around and be in the world. And then as they gradually get used to that, then we may invite them to turn on the motor and begin to drive. And we've got really good sound, but we also have a base-shaking platform, very low-cost device we've created that you feel the vibration of the motor. You can add in a character in the passenger seat, a soldier. You can add the smell of body odor or diesel fuel. We have a little smell machine.
Well, as I know you know, but in 1968, when I first started graduate school, this was exactly what I did. It was called systematic desensitization by reciprocal inhibition.
Right.
But it was all done in your head. It was, imagine yourself.
Yes.
doing this step by step. Yes. This is a lot more than just imagine.
Right, right. Well, you know, what's happened here is, you know, imaginal therapy, of course, is great. You can do it anywhere. And it's fairly effective with, you know, simple phobias, mm-hmm. that end of the anxiety disorder spectrum. But with PTSD, you know, you've got the added element of avoidance of cues and reminders of the traumatic event. And so it's a pretty tall order to expect that somebody's going to process emotional memories and imagination, or that you can even document or know what level they're at. So this is where virtual reality steps in. We can gradually, just like you would guide a patient in their imaginal exposure through a narrative that you help prompt them and they tell their story, we can do that, I think, in a more powerful way in the virtual environment by adding in elements progressively as the patient is able to handle.
Well, I think one obvious question that comes out of this is a vet comes out of Iraq with PTSD. Why would he sign up to get into a virtual Humvee? I mean, you know, you could sign up to get on a virtual island, like in Second Life, and, you know, have pina coladas.
Yeah. But I think most people, if they look back at the Vietnam era vets and some of the problems that came from that, where these folks, you know, actually became more inhibited and didn't start to go out more and so forth, we don't want to provide a mechanism for escape from reality. We want to basically develop a process whereby the person can cope with their past memories and know that those memories are in the past and that the present-day reality that they're in is not engendered by those same elements, that they can go down a street, they can walk by a Middle Eastern restaurant, they can see people wearing clothes from that environment and not have an anxiety attack or flashback.
I'm not challenging the rationale, because sure. I mean, this makes all the sense in the world to go very slowly and safely up to what you're afraid of. I think any good therapy does that. I guess what I'm questioning is, why would someone sign up for that?
I think there's one element that we have here that may add to the attraction, and that is that we have a generation of soldiers that have grown up digital, that have grown up with computer games, that are familiar with this sort of technology, although ours is sort of on steroids, so to speak. And I think there's an appeal to that, and it does sort of take off the onus of traditional psychotherapy, where you're going to delve into the darkest corners of the past. While that may be relevant in some cases, I think folks with PTSD want to be more problem-focused. And if the data that we've gotten so far in the literature on exposure therapy is any guidepost, I think for this particular disorder, you know, you do draw people in that might not go to traditional.
Yeah, I think for that disorder, for that population, in that context, it makes all the sense in the world. I wonder what happens when people feel so alienated and isolated, which is a byproduct of PTSD, mm-hmm. that they really need to connect with another human. Can that happen virtually?
Well, I think there's limits to what we can expect from the technology. At this point, I would never say that this type of virtual reality delivered exposure therapy would be a standalone tool that, you know, you just do this and go into this world and you're going to be fixed. I think there's a place for group counseling. I think if somebody's afraid to go into a vet center and become part of a group, I think the Second Life support group and some of the other online chat groups that exist are rational alternatives up to a point. But, you know, the data seem to indicate that overall you need to, in some way in therapy, address the trauma. You can't just ignore it and talk it away about talking about day-to-day things. But by really emotionally processing these memories that were traumatic, that's where you see the best gains. So just doing group alone or just doing, you know, online, very safe type counseling is good up to a point. But I think to really make a difference with these folks,
Well, you're also the therapy itself is giving them a sense of mastery over their own anxiety, which is nothing's more curative than that with virtually anything we have.
Right.
You know, and the mastery is critical. What do you see in the future when you look 5-10 years down? That's a long time for this kind of work. But
well, in PTSD, you know, recently the government has earmarked about $300 million to address PTSD and traumatic brain injury research, and I think from that we're going to see a lot of good research, not only on the treatment end, but a better understanding of the neuroscience that underlies PTSD. You know, 20 years ago, or before the DSM actually documented PTSD, most people thought of this as a disease of the will or cowardice or whatever, and that is so wrong, because now we know that there are brain changes in people that have this disorder, and perhaps we can, by understanding that better, we can spot people that may be predisposed to this and either provide specialized training, or perhaps the military isn't their best choice. So, well, we've got that angle. We've got ways of measuring different brain processes that may indicate cure. There's pharmacological agents now that may enhance the conditioning process when doing this kind of cognitive behavioral therapy. One drug called D-cycloserine seems to show some promise. So I think, well, we've gotten over the hump in accepting that this is an actual disorder that deserves serious treatment. Now we've got to understand the disorder and its brain-behavior relationships.
Well, this is fascinating stuff, and I look forward to seeing its development. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
My guest has been Dr. Albert Skip Rizzo. He's a research scientist and professor at the Institute for Creative Technologies at the University of Southern California. Earlier on, we heard from Dr. Craig Curley and Dr. Nick Yee. Curley is an Atlanta-based psychologist who practices in Second Life as an avatar. Yee is a PhD from Stanford University, where he studies the psychology of online games and virtual environments. If you'd like to contact us, our email address is voices@whyy.org, and you can listen to online on archived edition of our show at whyy.org/voices. And you can reach me at drdangottlieb.com. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Bob Perdig. Shane Ewing is our intern. Christine Dempsey is our executive producer. Elisa Walters is our associate producer. Voices in the Family is produced by Mike and Scott. I'm Dan Gottlieb. Honestly, enjoy your week, my friends. Day to day.